September 8th, 1981. Mount Vernon, South Dakota. 30-year-old John Mathis contacts police to inform them he has been shot in the arm after a struggle with a masked attacker on his farm. When police arrive, they discover that John's wife, LaDonna Mathis, and their two children, 4-year-old Brian and 2-year-old Patrick, have been shot to death. While John claims the masked attacker was responsible, investigators find a number of discrepancies in his story, and he is eventually charged with murdering his wife and 2 sons. However, John is acquitted of the crimes at trial, so the Mathis family murders officially remain unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we will be covering a particularly horrific crime, the 1981 murders of LaDonna Mathis and her 2 sons, Brian and Patrick. This is actually the first episode we've done about the unsolved murder of a family, and it's a pretty unique story. The patriarch of this family, John Mathis, claimed that he got into a struggle with an unidentified assailant who killed his wife and children, but the authorities did not buy his story and charged him with the murders. This story is reminiscent of a number of infamous cases in which parents have murdered their families and blamed the crime on an outside attacker, such as the Jeffrey McDonald and Darlie Routier cases. But the key difference which separates this case from the others is that when John Mathis went on trial for his crimes, he actually got acquitted and walked free. Not only that, but he also continued to raise his surviving son, who has always believed that his father was innocent. While there are a number of people who still believe John was guilty all along, the Mathis family murders are still officially unsolved, so I'm going to explore this case and try and determine who the most likely perpetrator was. However, before we get started, just a brief reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of these sites, because that will help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the Mathis family murders. Our story begins in the small town of Mount Vernon, South Dakota in 1981. Our central figure is 30-year-old John Mathis, who lives on a rural farm just outside of town with his 30-year-old wife, LaDonna Mathis. The couple have been married 8 years and have 3 sons, 4-year-old Brian, 2-year-old Patrick, and 9-month-old Dwayne. In July of that year, their farm was hit with 2 house fires, the second of which completely burned the home down to the ground. So while the house was being rebuilt, the family lived together inside a metal machine shed on the property and slept on cots. John and LaDonna did not think it would be a good idea for an infant to be sleeping inside a crowded shed alongside the rest of the family, so for the time being, LaDonna's parents would take care of Dwayne at their home in the nearby town of Mitchell. At 3:54 a.m. on September 8th, Doug Kirkus, a chief deputy with the Davison County Sheriff's Office, received a phone call at home from John Mathis, whom he had been friends with since high school. John told Kirkus that his family had just been shot, so Kirkus called the sheriff's office for assistance and drove out to the Mathis farm. When he got there, Kirkus crossed paths with John's father, Vern Mathis, who happened to be arriving at the farm at the same time because John had apparently called him as well. When Kirkus entered the machine shed, he saw John sitting on a cot with a bloody wound in his left arm. To his absolute horror, LaDonna, Brian, and Patrick Mathis were each lying dead of fatal gunshot wounds on their respective cots. LaDonna had taken 2 shots to the back of the head, Brian received 1 gunshot wound behind his ear, and Patrick was shot both in the left eye and the back of his neck. Ballistics would later show that Patrick was likely in a kneeling position on the bed when he received the second bullet. The 3 victims had been shot with Winchester Western Super X bullets from a .22 caliber semi-automatic Marlin rifle, and their approximate time of death was determined to be around 2:30 a.m. In addition, some graffiti had been sprayed on the shed door in gold paint, and it read, "Mathis sucks," though Mathis was misspelled with a U instead of an I. An ambulance was called to get John medical attention, and while being transported to the hospital, he reportedly told the attendant, "I'm going to get that son of a bitch." While John was being treated at the hospital, he was questioned by police and claimed that an unknown male attacker wearing a dark stocking over his head was responsible for his family's murders and the gunshot wound in his arm. Before he could provide a full account of what happened, Vern Mathis entered the room and asked the police to leave, claiming that his son had been through enough already. It wasn't until after John recovered from his wound and was released from the hospital that he provided investigators with the complete story. John claimed that he had been woken up at around 2 a.m. by Patrick, who needed to go to the bathroom. John took his son to use the outhouse before returning him to bed, but then heard some of the hogs outside making noise, along with his dog barking. John walked to the hog pen, which was located about 50 yards from the shed, in order to tend to them, and then went to tie up his dog. At this point, John claimed he heard the sound of a car pulling up, and he turned to see that the lights inside the shed were now on. When John rushed back to the shed, a man with a black stocking over his head came out, and he also happened to be carrying a .22 caliber rifle. This man immediately jumped John, and the 2 men struggled until the rifle went off, piercing John's left arm. This caused John to pass out, and when he woke up sometime later, the attacker was gone. When he walked inside the shed, John was horrified to discover that his wife and 2 sons had been shot to death, so he immediately went to the nearest phone to call Deputy Kirkus for assistance. The incident shocked the community, as this was the first murder to occur in Davison County since 1963, so people were frightened of the idea of an unknown killer trespassing onto people's property in order to shoot innocent children. However, right from the outset, Davison County Sheriff Lyle Swenson was very skeptical about Mathis's story. He immediately became suspicious when he learned that Mathis had decided to seek assistance by phoning his longtime friend, Deputy Kirkus, rather than calling the sheriff's office. When Sheriff Swenson was first notified about the murders at his home, he turned to his wife and said, "That damn Mathis shot his family." It wasn't long before John hired a lawyer and stopped speaking to the authorities. He stayed at his father's place and refused the police's request to return to his farm in order to reenact the events which took place on the night of the murders. Swenson's suspicions grew when he started looking into the house fires which hit the Mathis family farm 2 months earlier. At approximately 2:30 a.m. on July 9th, LaDonna had woken up when she discovered the house was on fire and noticed her husband was not in bed beside her. LaDonna immediately grabbed her 3 kids and narrowly escaped by rushing out of the house, where she discovered that John was already outside. He had conveniently gone outside to work on the farm and was not in the house when the fire started. You know, just as how he had conveniently gone outside to check on the hogs when a masked attacker went inside his shed and murdered his family. Anyway, the first fire only caused smoke damage to the house, but 13 days later, it caught fire again and completely burned to the ground. It was officially ruled to be an electrical fire, which was caused when lightning struck the electrical system, but Sheriff Swenson could not overlook the amount of close calls John had experienced on his farm in a short amount of time. But the most incriminating piece of evidence was when an unfired Winchester Western Super X .22 caliber shell was discovered in the pocket of John's pants after he was taken to the hospital. And incidentally, $100 was also found in his pocket, which seemed to rule out the possibility of robbery being the motive for the murders. But the shell was very similar to the bullets found inside the bodies of LaDonna, Brian, and Patrick. When questioned by police, John told them that he did not own a .22 caliber rifle, but never mentioned anything about the shell in his pocket. Well, Swenson knew that the key to building a case against John was to recover the murder weapon, so he arranged for a thorough search to be performed of the Mathis farm. The police combed over the entire property, including a manure storage pit, but they were unable to find any gun. They even took the step of seizing .22 caliber rifles from many of the other farmers in the area and sent them to the state firearms lab for testing, but none of them matched the slugs from the murder scene. It was theorized that John could have driven to nearby Lake Mitchell in order to dispose of the rifle before returning and phoning the police. But there was also speculation about John's father, Vern Mathis, who had seemingly arrived at the farm at the exact same time as Deputy Kirkus. Could Vern have been involved and help his son get rid of the murder weapon? Believe it or not, in order to recover the rifle, Swenson sought the help of a psychic from New Jersey named Dorothy Allison, who was known for assisting police investigations. If you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, you probably recognize her name, as they made an entire segment about her, and that's pretty much the only reason I'm mentioning this part of the story. According to Swenson, even though Dorothy was unable to help them find the gun, she claimed the killer's name had a capital M in it, and provided a series of numbers she claimed to have seen in her head, though she did not know how they were connected to the case. Well, to Swenson's surprise, he discovered that the numbers Dorothy provided were the license numbers on John Mathis's pickup truck. But obviously, they couldn't arrest Mathis over something a psychic said, and another piece of evidence which could not be recovered during the search of the farm was the gold paint used to spray the words, "Mathis sucks," on the shed door. If Mathis wrote the message himself, what did he do with the spray can? Well, in spite of these issues, police believed there was enough circumstantial evidence to launch a grand jury investigation, and Mathis was subpoenaed to testify and finally explain the Winchester .22 shell found in his pants pocket. John still stuck to his story that he did not own a .22 rifle and claimed that Patrick had found the shell on his property the night before the murders. After his son gave it to him, John stuck the shell in his pocket and forgot about it. He claimed that it wasn't uncommon to just stumble across shells on the ground in rural Davison County. In the end, the grand jury did not believe Mathis's story, and on October 30th, they formally indicted him on 3 counts of first-degree murder. If Mathis was convicted at trial, the prosecution said they would seek the death penalty. The community wasn't sure how to react to this. The overall consensus about the Mathises seemed to be that LaDonna was a very nice woman, while John was more aloof and introverted. But they didn't have any real reason to dislike John, and nobody knew of anyone who would have hated him so much that they'd attempt to murder him and his family and spray paint the message "Mathis sucks" at the crime scene. No one knew of any serious issues in the Mathis' marriage, and they certainly didn't think John had the capability or motive to murder his own children. And what also seemed odd is that his infant son, Dwayne, was staying with his maternal grandparents at the time of the murders, so if John wanted to get rid of his family, why would he do so on a night when his youngest child wasn't even present? Since Davison County was such a tight-knit community, John's defense attorneys argued that he'd never be able to receive a fair trial there, so a motion was granted to move the trial 100 miles away to the town of Yankton. The prosecution would push forward the theory that John had deliberately started the house fires which took place 2 months earlier with the intention of murdering his family and making it look like an accident. When this strategy failed to work, John took the step of shooting them and fabricating a cover story about a masked attacker being responsible. One of the big revelations at trial was the testimony of Kim Tatum, a 17-year-old neighbor who had babysat the Mathis children. She claimed that John had kissed and fondled her inappropriately on numerous occasions, and apparently told her he wished they had met before he started courting his wife. When Kim's mother found out about this, she apparently warned John to leave her daughter alone, or she would tell LaDonna. Without a murder weapon, the prosecution's case was comprised mostly of circumstantial evidence. They got weapons experts to testify that if he had used his right arm to use a .22 caliber rifle to shoot himself in the left arm, the bullet likely would have passed through the precise spot where his wound was located, a spot which also happened to be one of the least damaging places on the body where one could shoot themselves. One key piece of evidence presented at trial was his wristwatch, which had been broken during his alleged struggle with the attacker. Well, 2 jewelers would testify that the amount of damage on the watch seemed to indicate that it had been smashed multiple times. Since John had no marks on his left wrist when he was examined at the hospital, the implication seemed to be that he had taken off the watch to smash it himself. In addition, the time on the broken watch read 3:25, even though John claimed that he had woken up at around 2 a.m., and the approximate time of death for his family was 2:30. If John's wristwatch was smashed at 3:25, then this definitely did not jibe with the story of it being broken while struggling with a masked man. The prosecution also pointed out that the only blood found at the murder scene was inside the machine shed, even though the gunshot wound to John's left arm supposedly occurred outside. On the defense side, they put a lot of emphasis on the spray-painted graffiti message from the shed door, which read, "Mathis sucks." As you recall, Mathis was spelled with a U instead of an I, and the defense argued that John was not the type of guy who was clever enough to deliberately misspell his own name in order to throw off the investigators. In addition to the fact that no spray can containing gold paint was ever found on the Mathis property, there was never any trace of gold paint on John's hands or clothing that night. After the murders, John's hands were swabbed to see if he had recently fired a gun, and the results came back negative, though it was acknowledged that there likely wouldn't have been any gunshot residue on his hands if he had fired the gun while wearing gloves. The defense also countered the biggest piece of evidence, the .22 shell from John's pocket. They acknowledged that it was similar to the slugs found in the victims' bodies, but drove home the point that it could not be proven with 100% certainty that they were a match. They also got a rendering truck driver to testify that he had visited the Mathis farm shortly before the murders in order to shoot some crippled hogs with a .22 rifle, planting the idea that he could have accidentally dropped one of his shells there for Patrick to find. Of course, John's story about how the shell wound up in his pocket still seemed pretty unbelievable on the surface, particularly his absurd claim that it wasn't uncommon to just stumble across shells lying on the ground in that area. But believe it or not, this story may have actually worked to his advantage. During the trial, the jury was walking outside on a dinner break when the foreman happened to notice a spent shell on the sidewalk. And yes, it happened to be a Winchester Western Super X .22 caliber shell, the exact same type used in the murders, and by their own admission, the jurors were astounded by the coincidence and claimed it had a significant impact on them. No one can be certain just how much it ultimately influenced their decision, but on May 12, 1982, after deliberating for 3 days, the jury found John Mathis not guilty on all 3 counts of murder and acquitted him. In the end, they ultimately believed that without any witnesses, strong physical evidence, or the murder weapon, they just could not vote to convict him. Well, in spite of the acquittal, LaDonna's parents believed that John was guilty of the murders, but because he was the child's legal guardian, Dwayne would have to be returned to him. After John built a new house to replace the one which had burned down, he and Dwayne continued living on the farm in spite of what had taken place there. Dwayne never had any contact with his maternal grandparents, as John would say that if he allowed Dwayne to visit them, he feared they'd attempt to run away with him. Over the next several years, John and Dwayne would live very quiet, reclusive lives in which they rarely went into town and avoided interacting with people. John was not an overly popular figure in the community before the murders, but he now developed a reputation for being an unfriendly loner who was notorious for shooting dogs which wandered onto his property. During the 1990s, John sold his land and moved away to another farm, though Dwayne would continue living in the farmhouse. After a 30th anniversary article about the case was published in Mitchell's newspaper, The Daily Republic, Dwayne finally agreed to give his first interview. By this point, Dwayne was 30 years old, had served 6 years in the National Guard, including 1 tour of Iraq, and he and his girlfriend were expecting their first child. Dwayne made it clear that he staunchly believed in his father's innocence. He referred to John as a quote-unquote hard ass, and said that he grew up having to work long, tough hours on their farm, but he did not believe his father was capable of harming his mother and 2 brothers. The fact that John was willing to raise him on his own until adulthood was enough to convince Dwayne that he could not have done the things he was accused of. In his own words, quote, "I don't believe he did it. If he did it, I wouldn't still be here," end quote. As far as I know, John Mathis is still alive, but he has never spoken to the media about what happened and continues to live a very reclusive lifestyle. While the case is technically still open, the authorities have always believed they got the right guy all along. Because of double jeopardy, John cannot be tried for the crime again, so even if new evidence against him surfaced, it wouldn't make any difference. There haven't been any developments in the investigation since the conclusion of the trial, so officially, the Mathis family murders remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. One thing I like to do when covering older cases on this podcast is to not only look at it from a modern perspective, but examine it from the perspective of the time period when the story took place. Obviously, there's a major difference between looking at this case as a true crime fanatic in 2018, than looking at it as a juror at a murder trial in rural South Dakota during the pre-internet world of 1982. Right from the outset, I'll say that from the moment I saw John Mathis's account of what he claimed happened on the night of the murders, I saw nothing but red flags. And that's because I've studied so many cases just like this, where a parent claims that an unidentified assailant attacked them and their family, but even though their children were murdered, the parent managed to survive with superficial wounds. In my intro, I mentioned the Jeffrey McDonald case, which is probably the most famous example of this. I'm sure many of you are probably already familiar with it, but in case you're not, here's a quick rundown. Jeffrey McDonald was a doctor and army officer who lived in Fort Bragg, North Carolina with his wife Colette and their two daughters, 5-year-old Kimberly and 2-year-old Kristen. On February 17, 1970, Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen were all brutally murdered inside their home. Dr. McDonald claimed that a group of drug-addicted hippies broke in and attacked him, knocking him unconscious before they murdered his wife and children. While McDonald was wounded, his injuries were pretty minor compared to his family. By the end of the decade, McDonald would be convicted for the murders of his wife and two daughters and received life imprisonment. He remains incarcerated to this day, but has always maintained his innocence, and the case is still heavily debated and been the subject of numerous books and documentaries, which have taken both pro-guilt and pro-innocence viewpoints about McDonald. However, when you really delve into this case, it's clear to me that McDonald's story does not hold up, as the physical evidence supports the conclusion that he was the one who murdered his family, and that his story about being attacked by intruders is bunk. But the point is, you can see the similarities between the McDonald case and the murders of LaDonna, Brian, and Patrick Mathis. Much like Jeffrey McDonald, John Mathis claimed that he crossed paths with an attacker who murdered his family, but he was only left with a superficial wound which caused him to pass out. In the McDonald case, the word pig was written in blood on the headboard of his wife's bed, which was reminiscent of the Manson family murders which took place months beforehand. Since the McDonald home had a magazine containing articles about the Manson family, it's suspected that McDonald used it as an inspiration to stage the crime scene and concoct his story about being attacked by murderous, acid-loving hippies. Well, in the Mathis case, the words "Mathis sucks" were spray-painted on the door of the shed. How surreal would it be if Mathis had been inspired to stage a scene from the McDonald murders, which in itself was inspired by the Manson family murders? But the key difference between McDonald and Mathis is that when Mathis went on trial for the crimes, he actually wound up being acquitted. When he was interviewed for the 30th anniversary article, the attorney general who prosecuted the case said, quote, "As I look back, I would have recognized that there was a myth that parents cannot harm their children, number one. Number two, that sometimes myth overwhelms reason, because it's what we all want to believe," end quote. I think that remark makes a lot of sense and may help one understand why the jury chose to acquit Mathis. One of the reasons Jeffrey McDonald continued to have a slew of supporters after he was charged with his family's murders is because so many people could not reconcile the idea of a charming, well-respected daughter butchering his own children and then just moving on and resuming a normal life afterward. Even though John Mathis was not known for being an overly friendly person in the community, they still had a hard time imagining that a man like him could commit such a heinous crime. Yes, the McDonald murders did garner a lot of publicity, and there were other cases of parents murdering their children which took place before 1982, But remember, this was rural South Dakota, and there was no internet, so maybe this type of crime was unprecedented to a jury in the small town of Yankton, which is why they could not believe Mathis was guilty. But to be fair, the case against Mathis was very circumstantial, so I can see why a jury might have thought there was too much reasonable doubt to convict. After the trial, many of the jurors were interviewed about their decision, and while some of them held the belief that Mathis could have done it, but the state didn't prove their case, a lot of them genuinely seemed to believe that Mathis was innocent. And while I found Mathis' story to be very suspicious, I do acknowledge there are aspects of this crime which don't make a lot of sense, particularly the lack of apparent motive. What would have compelled this man to murder his wife and children? From what I can tell, LaDonna did not have a substantial life insurance policy, so John didn't gain anything financially from her death. It seems like the biggest sign that there may have been issues in the Mathis marriage was John's inappropriate behavior towards his teenage babysitter, Kim Tatum. Yes, the fact that John kissed and fondled her is pretty awful, along with his remarks that he wished he'd met her before he met his wife. So John was undoubtedly a creep, but it doesn't sound like Kim ever expressed the same interest in him, so did he really decide to murder his wife just because he hoped he might get together with her? When the jurors were interviewed, they stated that the testimony about John's lecherous behavior did not influence them that much. Not that they were excusing his actions, but they felt it was a major leap for someone to go from fondling a teenage girl to murdering their own wife and children. But the biggest sign that something might be wrong were the house fires which took place 2 months earlier, particularly the one which occurred while LaDonna and the three boys were inside the house, and John was conveniently working outside at 2:30 in the morning. You could easily infer that this was John's first attempt to kill his family, but when it didn't work, he had to come up with a murder scheme involving a fictitious masked intruder who murdered Donna, Brian, and Patrick while they were sleeping in the shed in the middle of the night. And once again, John was conveniently outside when it happened, which is why he managed to survive. On the surface, that seems pretty difficult to swallow, but let's examine all the evidence which leans both towards and away from Mathis's guilt. Right from the outset, there was suspicion about the fact that John called Deputy Kirkus at home rather than calling the sheriff's office for assistance. Now, if John's account of what happened was actually true, then I suppose you can't fault a guy for not thinking rationally after such a traumatic ordeal. It's not like John would have had a cell phone with a list of contacts, so maybe he decided to call Kirkus because he remembered his number, but did not remember the number of the sheriff's office. What's odd is that it's never specified in any of the sources which phone John made this call from, considering that his house had just burned down, it was in the midst of being rebuilt. But you could assume that John wanted the police officer who was his longtime friend to be the first one to arrive at the scene, as he'd have an easier time playing the sympathy card and convincing the authorities that his story was true. The two pieces of evidence which compelled the grand jury to indict Mathis for murder were his broken wristwatch and the .22 caliber shell found in his pants pocket. Investigators believe that John smashed the wristwatch himself to make it look like it was broken during a struggle, but the detail which is really hard to overlook is the fact that the time read 3:25. This is about 1 hour after the approximate death of his wife and children, and when Mathis claimed he went to the hog pen. I mean, there are possible explanations for this, such as that Mathis was mistaken about what time he woke up, or the time on his watch was just wrong. It's not really clear if this was a digital wristwatch or one which had hands, but if it's the latter, I guess the hands could have moved out of position while the watch was being smashed, so the time shown on it isn't accurate. As for the .22 shell, it's hard to overlook just how similar it is to the bullets found in the victims' bodies, though they could not conclude with 100% certainty that they were exactly the same. Even so, it seems like one hell of a coincidence that Patrick Mathis would just happen to find the shell on the ground and give it to his father the very night before he was shot with pretty much the exact same ammunition. I guess if John had mentioned the shell to investigators when he was originally questioned, this might not have seemed so suspicious, but he never shared his story about finding it until he was called to testify in front of the grand jury over 1 month later. But then, if you believe John is innocent, you could say that he had a great deal on his mind after having his family get murdered, so he might not have remembered that he had a shell in his pocket that night. However, in spite of the evidence against him, the biggest point in John's favor was the evidence which wasn't found, namely, the gold paint which was used to spray Mathis Sucks on the shed door, and the murder weapon. All indications are that the police searched every square inch of the Mathis family property and could not find a .22 caliber rifle, so that definitely opens up some questions. Some speculated that he could have traveled to Lake Mitchell and dumped the rifle there, but the issue is that he would have had to inflict the gunshot wound on himself before he got rid of the weapon, and driving back to the farm to call for help after being shot in the arm probably wouldn't be an easy task. One of the things which made investigators skeptical of Mathis' story is that no blood was found outside the shed where he was supposedly shot. But that also blows a small hole in the case against Mathis, because if the only blood they found was inside the shed, then how did Mathis not get blood anywhere else while he was disposing of the murder weapon? Well, in the eyes of people who believe John was guilty, the most logical explanation is that he got his father, Vern Mathis, to get rid of the gun and the gold paint for him, and dispose of them at a location where they've never been found. According to those who knew him, Vern doted on his son and thought he could do no wrong, but would he have been willing to go so far as to help cover up the murders of his daughter-in-law and grandchildren? On the night of the crime, Vern just happened to arrive at the property at the exact same time Deputy Kirkus did, and while John claimed that he called his father, you could assume that Vern was either returning after disposing of the murder weapon, or he'd been waiting there the whole time for the police to arrive. When John was being questioned by police at the hospital, it was Vern who stepped in and asked them to leave. Vern never stopped supporting his son and believing in his innocence throughout the entire ordeal, and he paid all of his legal fees. The fact of the matter is that while John was not dumb by any means, he was not a particularly clever or sophisticated man. By all accounts, he was the kind of guy who lived to work and put in long hours doing manual labor on his farm. John did not seem capable of dreaming up elaborate murder plots involving imaginary attackers, and like his defense attorney stated at trial, he was not clever enough to deliberately misspell his own last name when he spray-painted the shed, which sounds a bit oxymoronic, but that's beside the point. However, if John murdered his family and then called his father for assistance, then perhaps Vern was the one who came up with the story about the masked attacker and helped his son stage the crime scene. Another thing which lends credence to the possibility that John had help is the bizarre episode in which the jury foreman discovered a .22 caliber shell on the sidewalk during the trial. I really, really hope this incident wasn't the turning point which compelled the jury to acquit him. Just because you found a .22 shell on the sidewalk does not prove that John's story about his son finding a .22 shell on the ground is true. Do they think South Dakota is this magical place where .22 caliber shells come raining down from the sky? The jury foreman stated that he was astonished by the coincidence, but some people wondered if the shell might have been deliberately planted there, perhaps by someone from John's family, in hopes that the jury would find it and allow it to influence their decision. That does sound pretty far-fetched, but the odds against someone from that jury stumbling upon a shell like that by pure chance have got to be astronomical. Now, let's move past the evidence and focus on the one thing about this case which always makes me do a double take about John's guilt. If he wanted to murder his wife and children, why did he spare his youngest son, Dwayne, and then go on to raise him into adulthood? Remember, Dwayne was only 9 months old at the time, and staying with his maternal grandparents, so if John committed this crime, he made a conscious choice to carry out the murders on a night he knew Dwayne wouldn't be there. So let's take a moment to talk about another similar story which I mentioned in my intro, the Darlie Routier case. In summary, Darlie Routier is a woman who is currently on death row in Texas for the 1996 murders of her two sons, 6-year-old Devin and 5-year-old Damon. Darlie always claimed that an unknown intruder broke into her house and attacked both her and her sons with a knife, so yes, this is yet another case in which two children were brutally murdered, but the parents survived the attack. This case has always been controversial, but in my personal opinion, the evidence shows there was no intruder, and that Darlie herself committed the crime. But I think one of the main reasons this case is still heavily debated over 20 years later is because it's really not clear what her motive could have been. Darlie had a third child, a 7-month-old son named Drake, who was sleeping upstairs with his father that night. So what would compel a mother to stab two of her children to death, but spare her youngest one. And this same logic applies to John Mathis. In many cases where parents murder their children, it's because they consider them to be a burden and don't want to raise them anymore. After Jeffrey McDonald's family was murdered, he moved across the country and seemed quite happy to get a fresh start and be free of his responsibilities as a husband and father. But in John Mathis's case, his life really didn't change much at all after he was acquitted. He just went back to working on his farm and raising his surviving son Dwayne, only this time he had more responsibility because he was a single father and had to do it alone. If he no longer wanted children, he probably could have relinquished custody of Dwayne to his maternal grandparents, but he raised him into adulthood, and as far as some people are concerned, that's proof positive that John did not commit the murders. But you also have to keep some other things in mind. The initial fire at the Mathis house in July took place while LaDonna and all three of her children were at home, so if John deliberately started that fire, then Dwayne could have been killed too. I'm not sure who ultimately came up with the idea for Dwayne to stay with LaDonna's parents until the house was rebuilt, but if it wasn't John's idea, maybe he figured that getting rid of Dwayne was now out of his hands and he'd have to make do with murdering LaDonna, Brian, and Patrick. Maybe he was actually fine keeping Dwayne because he was still an infant and could now raise him from scratch the exact way he wanted to without his wife's interference. I can't imagine how difficult it must have been for LaDonna's parents to give Dwayne back to John since they believed he committed the murders. It's kind of a tough situation from a legal standpoint because John was Dwayne's legal guardian and he was technically acquitted of the crime, but I'm sure there was fear that if he was capable of murdering his other two sons, he could potentially do the same thing to Dwayne as well. Ultimately, that might be the reason John continued raising Dwayne, because if anything happened to him, he knew that suspicion would instantly fall upon him. On the bright side, from what I've seen of Dwayne, it does seem he grew up into a level-headed guy who served his country in Iraq and was starting a family of his own, so it looks like being raised by a suspected murderer wasn't too damaging for him. And in John's defense, Dwayne staunchly believes in his innocence. But really, what else is Dwayne going to say? He was too young to remember his mother, his brothers, or anything about the murders, so John is the only parent he's known, and you can't blame him for thinking that his father was incapable of such a heinous crime. When you look at the situation as a whole, if John was the perpetrator, he committed three murders which did not seem to benefit him or change his life in any positive way. He spent nearly four decades raising a son while living in the exact same community, doing the same work as a farmer, except that he's had to live with the stigma of being a potential murderer. So did these past 36 years demonstrate that John Mathis may not have actually done the things he was accused of? Well, I'm sorry, I just can't come to any other conclusion than him being guilty as sin. Yes, the murder weapon was never found, and yes, there never seemed to be any clear-cut motive, but the biggest issue here is that investigators have never even come remotely close to finding any evidence which points to another suspect who committed this crime. I can understand why people still debate the Jeffrey McDonald case, because there was actually another suspect who confessed to being involved in the murders, even though she was an unreliable drug addict. But in this case, there's nothing. What reason would there be for a mysterious masked killer to stop at a rural farm in the middle of the night, enter a shed, and murder a woman and two young boys? Okay, you might be thinking that it was some serial killer who was passing through the area and decided to pick the first place they saw to commit a crime, because sometimes murderers just pick their victims at random. But this particular perpetrator left a message behind which read, "Mathis sucks," which suggests that he knew the victims and had some sort of grudge against Mathis. But then how come authorities couldn't find any suspects who had such a hatred towards Mathis that they would commit this sort of crime? This was a close-knit farming community, so if anybody from the area had that kind of vendetta against Mathis, people would have talked. The only people who seemed to have any issues with Mathis were Kim Tatum and her family because he had kissed and fondled her, but I somehow doubt that's going to incite them to murder his wife and his two children. And of course, if someone hated Mathis that much, why incapacitate him with a minor gunshot wound to the arm and not finish the job? If this attacker actually existed, then he pretty much just vanished into thin air and got away with the perfect crime. I just don't buy it. I've covered quite a few cases on this podcast in which the police did a lousy investigation or had serious tunnel vision and focused on the wrong person, but I cannot fault the Davison County Sheriff's Office on this one. From what I've read about Sheriff Lyle Swenson, he sounds like a stand-up guy, as he was eventually appointed to become the United States Marshal for the District of South Dakota by President Bill Clinton, and it sounds like his department worked diligently to try and find the murder weapon. When that didn't work out, they built the best case against Mathis that they could, but it just didn't pay off at the end. And to Swenson's credit, even though he believed Mathis was guilty, that still did not prevent him from exploring other possible leads after the trial, but they always led to a dead end, and not one shred of evidence could be uncovered which pointed to another perpetrator. The case for Mathis's guilt isn't perfect, of course, but I think a lot of the discrepancies can be explained away if you believe that he had help committing the crime or disposing of the evidence. Since Vern Mathis has passed away, we'll probably never know for sure if he was involved. Now, given that the case against him was largely circumstantial, could I have voted Mathis guilty beyond a reasonable doubt if I was on the jury for that trial? That's hard to answer for certain, but there's no way I can believe he's innocent. Unfortunately, this sounds like a case in which an evil psychopath did an unthinkable thing and did not receive the appropriate punishment. But in a way, John was condemned to spend the rest of his life in a personal prison of his own. Yes, it would have been much more preferable if he had been locked up for the rest of his life, but ever since his acquittal, he has become a pariah in the community and been forced to live a very reclusive, isolated life, with his only company being a son he may not have even wanted in the first place. I just cannot fathom how a person who fired bullets into the heads of his wife and two sons, aged 4 and 2, could go on living with himself and keep raising another child, but it's clear there was something deeply wrong with John Mathis, and that he is probably wired in a way which normal people will never understand. So overall, I don't think this case is much of a whodunit, so much as it is a whydunit. In many cases where parents murder their families, you can see what may have driven them to commit such an unthinkable, heinous act, but here, I just don't know. And unlike those other cases, the perpetrator has been allowed to go on living as a free man with no fear of facing any punishment for his crimes, but I think these past 4 decades have only opened up more questions than answers. This case is still officially unsolved, of course, so if Mathis was the perpetrator all along, nothing else can be done, since he can't be charged and tried for the same crime again. So we may never learn the full truth about what happened, unless John decides to make a deathbed confession someday. However, should you happen to have any information which points to someone else besides John Mathis being the perpetrator, the case is still open, so please make sure to contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. And since we're entering a new month, it is now a good time to send a special thanks to our recurring monthly donors. And they are Don, Amber, Brian, Casey, Ellie, Kathleen, Keisha, Laura, Megan, Clinton, Lewis, Aura, Claire, Elliot, Heather, Eleanor, Purity, and Laura Lee. So thank you very much, guys. And if I happen to miss your name by mistake, be sure to let me know and I'll correct it. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or the cases we feature with myself and your fellow listeners, feel free to join, and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. And if you want to meet me, I will mention again that The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel in Nashville from May 4th to the 6th. So if you're planning to attend and need to purchase tickets to the events, you can receive a 10% discount if you visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TTWC. That's TTWC. Like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, So if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put in this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week and join me next Wednesday, which happens to be Valentine's Day, as we're going to deliver a special Valentine's Day themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm sorry.